Leaders are influencers, and it's nearly impossible to maximize your influence when you're being dragged down and distracted by crippling anxiety, overwhelming stress, and private doubts and fears. We're unlocking the secrets to being fully present, expanding our potential, and growing our wisdom. Welcome to the Calm and Confident Leader Podcast with your host, Jason Stonehouse. Jason is the founder and lead coach at Life in Process. He helps professionals and leaders conquer anxiety and fear so they can maximize their potential. And now, grab something to write with and engage in today's episode.
Well, hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Calm and Confident Leader Podcast. This is Jason Stonehouse, and I have a very special episode of the Calm and Confident Leader Podcast for you today, because I have a guest with me, Britt Frank, the author of The Science of Stuck. I would say my favorite book from 2022. I think you're going to find so much wisdom in this. She has done so much research, has a ton of experience in this area, particularly in areas like stress, anxiety, managing emotion, boundaries, self-care. We talk about a lot of these different things on this episode, and we may actually break this interview into two parts, so stay tuned for that. We'll see how it goes. But I'm really excited for you to be able to hear this, because as a leader, she tailors our conversation. She doesn't just kind of give me the normal, you know, a lot of times when you have interview guests, you get people who get on and they kind of have their same spiel and they just kind of do it. But her and I went deeper and went specific to apply this to people in leadership roles who have the kinds of pressures that you and I are facing every day. So I think you're going to find so much wisdom. I would encourage you. I know a lot of you like to listen to this in your car or whatever, but if you can, get a pad and paper, get your iPad, whatever it is, because you're going to want to take some notes, because there is some really applicable things here in this episode. And I also want to invite you to join me over at calmconfidentleader.com, calmconfidentleader.com. And that is our website, and you're going to find lots of things, and that is growing every single day. And we've got a whole new website that we're going to be launching. Probably by the time you listen to this, it may even be up, but some online courses and lots of things that I know you're going to find great value in. So check that out, and if it's not updated yet, keep checking back every couple days or a week, and you will see some brand new stuff happening over there at that website. All right, guys, let's get into probably part one of the interview with Britt Frank. Hello, and welcome you. I have Britt Frank with me today. She is the author of The Science of Stuck, and I am an avid reader of this, and Science of Stuck is probably my favorite book 2022. I have purchased it for family members. I've recommended it to several of my clients, and so I am truly honored. Thank you so much for being here, Britt.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah. So there's so many directions that we could go in our conversation. So I want to focus our time on some of the top issues that our listeners are dealing with, particularly being leaders, high capacity leaders, executives, CEOs, those types of folks. So just to kind of start where your book starts, I found that many of us as leaders deal with anxiety, even though we've had a hard time calling it anxiety. I think there's just been a stigma around that idea. But I know for me, I've probably been dealing with anxiety since I was in my 20s, but I never would have called it that until maybe about 8 years ago, because I just called it stress. You know, I'm just dealing with stress. But now that I understand anxiety, I'm sure that that is really what's going on. So I'm not sure how critical it is that we insist on people use the right term. However, what I'm most interested in is how do we leverage stress, anxiety to help us get unstuck, which is obviously the title of your book, Science of Stuck. So how do we leverage anxiety to help us?
Sure. And going back to your point before, I think using accurate language to describe what we're experiencing is absolutely pertinent, because okay, you cannot solve a problem if you're not describing it accurately. And so a lot of times people will think they have one problem. And this is true in the business world too. You know, your employees come to you with a problem and it's like, that's actually not the problem. That's the felt problem, but that's not the problem that needs to be solved.
Right.
And so I agree with you, the word anxiety in the corporate and my private practice is full of very high functioning CEOs, business leaders, and everyone hates the word anxiety, including me. So let's not call it that. Let's call it what it is, which is nervous system activation. If you want to be like super fancy, you can call it SNS, sympathetic nervous system activation, or you can just call it activation, because it takes all the morality, all the strong versus like, you know, tough guys don't get anxious. It's like, okay, cool. But every human who has a nervous system, which includes all of us, has sympathetic nervous system activation. SNS activation is a thing. So that word seems to start us in a better place, because we're not starting with the stories and the stigma and the shame and the, I don't have anxiety. It's like, okay, you're activated. Cool. What do we do now? Now we can get into the heart of the problem. So your question, how do we leverage nervous system activation? Well, let's start by realizing what it is. It's not a character flaw. It's not a weakness, but it's also not mental. And this is my biggest thing with any microphone I'm ever given, is that anything that we call a mental health thing is not mental. So sympathetic nervous system activation, aka anxiety, aka stress, is not a mindset issue. It's a physiological issue. So in other words, stress is not in your head, it's in your body. So how do we activate, how do we leverage it? Well, let's start by understanding that what it is a physiological response, which is just at its base level, that's just energy. It's energy units that you can use to either spin, to tell yourself stories, to be really, really go, 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 and not be able to stop, or to be able to leverage that in the direction that we want. Because for high functioning people, motivation is not the panacea. It's like, if you're high functioning and high achieving, you've already figured out motivation, but it's not enough to just do well. We want to be well. That's why I like your work about, it's not just leadership, it's calm leadership. It's not just be effective, but it's feel good while being effective. And we need to understand anxiety is nervous system activation. It's not in your head, it's in your body. And that's the starting place. If you're going to leverage it, we have to describe it accurately.
So one of the things that I say with my clients is that anxiety, or actually I used to use all emotion as like a dashboard in a car. You know, it gives us that warning light, but the issue is not in the dashboard. We don't stick the nozzle when it says E, we don't stick it into the dashboard. We stick it into the gas tank to fill it up. So the dashboard only points to something else, really, as you're saying, that's happening in our bodies. It's not necessarily that. So how do we learn to become better identifiers of that dashboard, or which light is lit up and where do I need to respond?
Sure. And I love that metaphor. I use it in my book. Like, anxiety is the check engine light of your mind. And when the light comes on, the light's not the problem. When your gas tank is on E, the E is annoying, but it's not actually the problem. And so what happens with anxiety, or whatever we want to call it, is people will come in and the very first question, especially in the business world, because everyone in the business world they were all taught, rightfully so, start with why. You have to start with why. That's great if you are trying to manage a business. That is the absolute number one thing that will keep you stuck if you're trying to figure out your mind's dashboard and emotional literacy and physiological fluency. Never start with why. Never, ever. And everyone, why am I feeling so anxious? This is stupid. Why am I feeling like this? I shouldn't be. It's like, okay, great. But like, you are. So you don't ask why a building is on fire when you see it on fire. You get the people out, you put the fire out, and you get to why later. So the number one way, like, first to start as a leader, or as you're leading people, because I guarantee you, if you are managing a team, all of the people on your team are going to be like, why am I feeling like this? It's like, I don't know. And it doesn't matter. What's beautiful about what we know about the brain and the body is you don't need to know why you're stuck to get unstuck. So your question, how do we start working with this dashboard? Well, let's start by taking the why. If everyone would take the why do I feel this off the table, we would all get moving a lot faster. Why is a good question. It's just not the starting question when you're talking about emotional intelligence and physiological fluency. So don't start with why is my thing.
Okay. So what do you start with then when you do notice that, like you said, you're activated? Or do you use the word triggered at all, or do you not like that word? Is it overplayed?
I think that word has gotten a lot of it's become so trendy that it's become, it's like, it, are you triggered or do you just not like what's happening? Are you triggered or do you just feel uncomfortable? Sure. So I don't particularly care for that word.
So activated. Okay. So when you are activated, then what is the first step if it's not why?
First step is, where in my body am I feeling this? Just take a second. Is it in my chest? Is it, it's usually, you know, in your throat, your chest, your stomach, your extremities. Take a second and just, where in my body am I feeling all this stuff? Doing that, like the act of, it's a physics principle. The act of observing something changes the thing. The very act of observing your physiology is going to calm it down a few knots. It's not going to make everything magically better, but it will settle it. It'll take you from a 10 to an 8. Step one, where in my body do I feel this? Step two, what are three choices available to me? People, places, thoughts, things, doesn't matter. Three choices available to me right now that will help me feel a little less up. Like, what's my brake pedal? Of those three, pick one, pick the easiest one, do it, repeat. So step one, where? Step two, what are three choices? Step three, pick one and go, and we'll figure out why later. That's a simple formula, but it works.
Yeah. Good. I love that. So before we go any further, let's define stuck. What do we mean when we say that someone is stuck?
I appreciate the opportunity to clarify that, because my disclaimer here is, when I'm talking about the science of stuck and being stuck as a leader, as a person in a relationship, I am not referring to situations where you have no choices. So if you are in an abusive relationship, if you are in an oppressive environment, if you are in, say, a war-torn country, those are not the situations to which I use the word stuck. So let's put that on the side. So stuck means there's no logical reason why you're not doing what you want to be doing. There's no logical explanation for why the intention action gap is 7,000 miles wide. Nevertheless, you're not doing the thing. You're not doing what you know you could be doing, what you know you want to be doing. And so there's science behind that. And that's what I call stuck.
Okay. One of the things that I often do with my clients is I try to get to the root underneath the presenting issues. So I'm amazed at how many coaches and counselors tend to major in the symptom management or behavior modification. And I'm assuming when I talk about the root, you would probably use maybe a phrase like unprocessed trauma. Is that at the root of many of our issues? Is that trauma piece? Because I know you have a chapter on kind of dealing with trauma and the healing of trauma, that kind of thing. Is that what you would use maybe at the root of most of our quote unquote issues?
So the word trauma has become problematic as has the word, especially in the corporate world. It's like really trauma? Like, Britt, it's not trauma. It's like, okay, well, yes, it is. But again, we need to use language that we can work with.
Okay.
So rather than and I agree with you, getting to the root of things is helpful, but people hear that and they think, oh, now I have to hate my mother and now I have to forgive my father. And so instead of root cause, I like to focus on not the root cause, but what's the function of the symptom, not behavior management, but this behavior, whether it's something like taking a drug or drinking too much or overworking or whatever, there's a function to the behavior, and identifying the function is necessary to sustain change. Because if we don't know what the function is, then you can do all the behavior mod in the world, but you know, your brain is habituated to be functional, not to be productive. So if there's a functionality, and all behavior, even suboptimal behavior, is functional, we need not root cause, even though that can be helpful. But sometimes you don't know the root cause.
Right,
it's like,
forget
the root cause. What's the function of this behavior? Identifying function will sustain a long-term change. So that's my thing.
Yeah. So when there is something that is functionally working, but we don't want it, you're saying, drugs, alcohol, whatever aspect I'm going to, how do I find something that is as effective in functioning, right? So because a lot of what I would think of, and I'm just kind of spitballing with you here, but a lot of things that I would think of are probably going to take longer to have the same impact, but it's going to be a healthier impact and it's going to be a longer term impact than, you know, the immediate. So how do I learn to make that swap for two functional things, one being healthy, one being maybe less healthy?
Sure. Well, and this comes down to, are you willing to be honest with yourself about what's going on? And a lot of people are not, with things as, you know, I want to go to the gym and get fit. Nevertheless, I'm sitting on the couch watching hour 12 of whatever the thing is. It's right. Like, well, I know you want to get fit, but what's the function of you're not doing that? There's no reason. I'm just lazy. It's like, okay, well, lazy is not a biological reality. That's a judgment. There's a function here. And for some people, the function of not going to the gym is I'm worried if I get fit. This one is such a, like, no one talks about this, but I've heard it often enough behind closed doors that it's a thing. I'm worried if I get fit and healthy, I will no longer be attracted to my spouse. And then I'm going to realize how bad my marriage is and I'm going to want to leave. Now, that's not always true, but that's the function. And we have to be willing to get honest about functionality. I'll use myself because I was a drug addict for a while. The function of my addiction largely was I don't want to deal with certain things. And as long as I have this big giant problem that I've created over here, I don't need to deal with my pain over there. And so we need to break this myth that there's an easy way to relief. Like, all relief comes with a cost. Yes, drugs will give you relief before they stop doing that and then they destroy your life. But, you know, relief at what cost? Not going to the gym is going to give you instantaneous relief, but relief at what cost? And that's why I like doing a cost-benefit analysis with all behavior, because until you identify all the benefit, we all know the cost of inertia, the cost of not making the sales calls, the cost of not networking. We know that. But what are the benefits? No one wants to talk about that. If we can get honest about our cost-benefit analysis, then we can start actively making changes, but not until we list the benefit column. And that's ugly stuff and no one wants to do it.
So why is benefits ugly? Benefits, I would think, would be positive, attractive.
Benefits to unhealthy behaviors.
Oh, to unhealthy behaviors. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
And no one wants to be like, and again, I'll use myself. I certainly am not a victim blamer, having survived all kinds of nonsense. I stayed in bad relationships, and that doesn't mean it was my fault. And it doesn't mean I deserved what happened. But one of the functions of staying in a bad relationship for me was, as long as I was with someone who was worse than me, then I could be good. Like, look, they're bad. I'm good. Therefore, I don't have to deal with any of my smelly stuff. I don't have to clean out my closets, because look at what they're up to. Okay. And that's an ugly truth. But once I named it, I could change it. You have to name it to Dr. Dan Siegel says, you have to name it to tame it. Right, and that is very true with whatever the thing is that we say we want to change.
And then on the flip side, when I'm listing out benefits of going to the gym, for example, and what that's actually going to bring, you would say that's where my motivation then should start to shift. Yes.
Well, okay. So with going to the gym, I love this stuff so much. Yeah. So we all know the benefits of going to the gym, but what about the costs? When you like, I love going to the gym now, but when I was using drugs and smoking a pack of cigarettes, you know, and eating like Quick Trip food all day, it hurts to go to the gym when you haven't been. It is so, getting out of bed at 5 a.m. and I live in the Midwest when there's a foot of snow on the ground. It is really unpleasant. So with the good stuff, we all want to list the benefits and ignore the costs. With the bad stuff, we all want to count the cost but ignore the benefits. And we need both in order to do any type of meaningful, sustainable change.
Okay. So I know we kind of shied away from the trauma, and I understand why you say that, but would you say it is possible to heal from some of those wounds, some of those things that have happened in the past without a therapist? And if so, what would be involved in, or do you not even go there? Do you kind of just talk about getting emotion? And I guess what I'm saying is there's a sequence to, I think, what you're talking about. And a lot of times what people are putting as first, you're saying, nope, no, I don't want to see you do that first. We're going to get there, but I don't want to see you do that first. But I assume you eventually want to get there. It's just the sequencing of, I need to get some low-hanging fruit, and get some motion going before I get to that quote-unquote healing of that past. And is there a point where that healing is no longer necessary because I have enough motion, or can I heal without a therapist, I guess, was the main question. But obviously, I got a couple others lumped in there.
Yeah. And I love, we're speaking very much the same language. can you heal without a therapist? Well, it depends on what your definition of healing is. Like I'll have someone come to me and say, I want to work on my trauma. And obviously I'm a trauma expert. Trauma's real. I just, the word gets so overused. Yeah. I like to change it, but okay. You have trauma. Great. Well, you're drinking 3 pots of coffee a day. You're working 20 hours a day. You have no friends. You are absolutely chained to your desk. There's nothing I can do for you until you have some ecosystem shifting, because we can't do any type of deep inner healing if your external environment can't support that. So there is an order of operations here. Can you get functional without a therapist? Absolutely. Can you like sustain long-term momentum? Can you stop being an addict? Can you create better relations? You can do lots of things without a therapist. Can you heal? Well, if you're operationally defining that as understanding root cause and going into the analysis, it would be hard, but therapists aren't the only people who have access to the information. There are wonderful coaches. I've had some people who didn't even know they were actively healing my stuff, that were actively speaking into my wounds and healing my stuff. Like, can you heal a mother wound without a therapist? Yes. Can you heal a father wound without a therapist? Yes. So can you heal without a therapist? I'll go with sure. It'll be hard if you have no access to trauma information and neuroscience information, but can you? Absolutely.
Okay. So I love how you say that the reason that we have trouble changing things is because they are functioning. They are accomplishing something for us. So what may our, and maybe you've alluded to this already, or maybe you've already spoke to it, but the issue of talk to some of the things that our stuckness actually does for us. Like the fact of just staying stuck and maybe some of the benefits that we think it's giving us.
Yeah. And I have in my book, like, here are the 9 benefits to staying stuck. One of them is physiological. It's energy conservation. Again, I don't know why our brains are designed this way. I didn't design it. Like, if you have issues, you can like speak to the management, but our brains are not designed for higher level concepts like productivity and accomplishment and even love. I mean, you can make a spiritual case for that. But if we're just talking physiology, our brains are designed to conserve energy. And so it takes less energy to not do something than to do something. Now, we want to train our brain that there are long-term implications. So we don't want to just think about conserving energy in the immediate, but we need to know that our brain's immediate impulse will always be surviving a threat, conserving energy, or scanning out an opportunity to go on to autopilot. Our brains love autopilot because it's energy conservation. It takes less energy to just sort of automatically go through something. So there's that. Another benefit to staying stuck is image preservation. I cannot tell you how many friends I lost when I got healthy and I started running a successful business. Like, where'd all my people go? So, you know, you are going to be viewed differently if you shift, because all change, even positive change, is going to be upsetting to people who are not committed to the same process. And that's unfortunate. And so your image and a lot of your relationship equilibrium is going to get distorted by you getting unstuck. That doesn't mean you shouldn't get unstuck. It doesn't mean I should go back to doing what I was doing, but it was really hard and it was very jarring to me when I'm like, wait a second. Oh, part of this healthy healing, yay, my life is good process is grieving all of the things and people that I'm going to lose as a result of getting unstuck.
Wow. That's huge. So in getting the movement past that stuck place, because you're right, you already, you just listed 2 of the 9. And I'm like, wow, those are pretty attractive things or pretty scary things to let go of. So is this where your cost benefit analysis still comes in? Or is there another tool that you bring in to help, you know, make that shift or paint the make the case that it's worth getting unstuck?
Well, for some people, they may not come to that conclusion. Like, I think it's always worthwhile to get unstuck.
Right.
I worked with a gentleman who was like, if I commit to this process, I am legitimately going to lose my connection to my father and my connection to my brother. And here are all the benefits you get, but you get your health and you get your happiness and you get love and like your relationships are going to be healed and you get lots of more money because, you know, you're going to make more money being healthy. This person was not willing to walk away from those relationships. Now, I had to walk away from family relationships. So for me personally, I wouldn't have done that. But for some people, having to lose these primary relationships is a price they're not willing to pay. And it's not up to you or me to judge that. Right. Even though, you know, the cheerleader in me is like, come on, you can do it. And this is going to be great. And it's a sacrifice and a seed must fall to the ground in order to bear fruit. And those are your seeds. So bury them. But it's not up to me to say that.
Right.
So, but that person had to get really honest and say, I want all of these things. This is the cost. I'm not willing to pay that. So, okay. Like, that's a bummer. But then that's where grief work comes in. And you will very rarely ever see that grief is part of the price of getting unstuck. It's a big price. It's worth it. It's always worth it to me. But that's a hard sell.
Right. Yeah. Okay. But still, just to answer the question, the cost benefit analysis tool is still what I'm going to look at, because at least then I have things down on paper, for example. And like you said, I can look at those costs and I can look at those benefits and I can say, am I willing to pay this price because I'm going to get this? And is this, so it's almost like the thing I've done a lot of work around change management, the thing that you're trying to invite people to change to, the cost of that change has to be worth it to make the amount of change that we're looking to make.
Yes. And the person I was referring to who wasn't willing to make certain changes because of the sacrifice, fine. Like, let's stop spending a lot of your money and a lot of our time spinning on this. You know, it's not working. And it's like, okay, you're not willing to do this, so you can't have this. But what are you willing to say yes to? And if we can get, and again, take the morality off of it, take the judgment and shame off of it. It's like, what are you willing to say yes to? Because wherever there's a yes, there's potential for something. You may not get all the things, but that doesn't mean we can't get some of the things. And maybe the shift from the little will spark renewed interest in doing the big. So there's always a yes, even if it's a micro yes. A micro yes is better than no yes. So like a micro step forward, do it.
Yeah, because I think with a lot of the leaders that I work with, it's such a black and white dichotomy of either like, I'm either all in or I'm all out, you know? And so that idea of find your yes, find that simple yes that you can say, even though you may not be able to do the whole thing, that's really rolling the rock up the hill for a lot of these leaders who are like, no, I'm either going to do this and I'm going to be, because that's what really got them to this position, right? Is they knew they had to throw themselves all into as an entrepreneur or whatever to get to this place. So I think that's even a hard sell, is saying, hey, you're not going to do the whole thing, but we are going to do something.
And I get it. And I didn't say yes to having the life that I have now, which I'm all in and I'm super passionate about. I said yes years ago to just like staying alive that day. I said yes to taking a shower that day. And I think as leaders and people who have said, anyone who's in a position of leadership has said a lot of yeses to things, to uncomfortable things, to unpleasant things to get there. So this, I'm all in, well, that's cool, but like your people are not. So if you're going to be a leader of humans, we have to meet them where they're at. And I have a lot of leaders that say to me like, but there's all this feeling stuff. And how do I balance this dance between demanding performance and having compassion? And it's like, you can be compassionate and still be demanding. Those are not mutually exclusive things. There's a way to do it, but it starts with helping people find their own yes, even though that yes might be small for where you are now. It's big for where they are.
Yeah, I talk a lot about the difference between like the big leaps and the the baby steps, to use, you know, What About Bob, you know, but that idea of being able to say, you know, if you wanted, we very rarely take big leaps in our life. It's always those baby steps, but we just got to make sure that the baby steps are all moving. You know, I always say, what does forward look like from here? You know, what is this, the next step? So we at least we're going forward. We know, we don't maybe even fully know the vision of where that healthy person's going to be, but at least we can take a step in that direction. And before you know it, you look back and you say, wow, that big leap I wanted to take, I actually got here probably with a lot less pain than if I would have taken a big leap and just said, you know, forget it, I'm dropping everybody, I don't want to deal with this issue, you know? So yeah. Okay. I love it.
Man, isn't that good stuff?
Yeah, the whole episode, the whole interview was so rich, and I can't wait for you to hear the rest of the interview. We'll talk about that more on our next podcast episode.
So I'd love for you to join me there. But in the meantime, why don't you go on Amazon or wherever you buy your books and get The Science of Stuck by Britt Frank. I highly recommend it. It will be a game changer for your relationships, for your leadership, and just for who you are as a person. I would love to have you check out calmconfidentleader.com, our website, where you're going to get all kinds of resources, also find out about coaching and some new online courses that will be coming real soon. So join us over there, and we'll see you on our next episode.